House Education Committee will come to order. Thank you, colleagues and guests. As we move forward into our informational meeting and ongoing effort to bring all kinds of information before us for our consideration, review, and analysis, Steve Bogart, I understand, would like to come forward and introduce our panel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Bogart. I currently serve as chair of the State Board of Education. And it certainly is my pleasure and honor to introduce two members of the Department of Education staff on which we rely regularly and to a great extent for our information and have proved more than adequate for our needs. Dr. Patberg and Doug Koski are members who staff that regularly provide input to the board and I guess provide us the resource and information that we request of them, and we have utmost trust. I do thank you for the opportunity. I am grateful that you share our concern. Mr. Koski made a presentation to the board yesterday at our regular meeting that I believe you'll see today because we have ongoing review requirements of ourselves and actually have an awful lot of interest in providing the best assessment system possible for education system. So again, if I could introduce Pat Burke and Doug Koski. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming.
Good afternoon, Representative or Chair Flores and representatives. My name, for the record, is Doug Koski. I'm Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services. And with me today is Pat Burke.
Madam Chair, good afternoon, members of the committee. It's very nice to be back in front of you. We have a number of things that you have asked us about today, and we want to jump into that as quickly as possible. We have a lot to talk about. The topics today are the assessment system, the No Child Left Behind Act, and a concept contained within No Child Left Behind known as adequate yearly progress. So there's a lot to talk about there. So if by way of just grounding us as a starting point, I refer you, and I put in your handout a copy of Oregon Revised Statute 329-485. This is state law that directs the Department of Education to implement an assessment system. And I'd like to point out just a couple of key elements of the statute, and then Mr. Koski is going to talk about how we operationalize that. You notice that the system is supposed to be, according to state law, a criterion reference system. Let me explain that term very briefly. There are basically two types of assessment. One are called normed assessments, where a particular test, an example, might be the Scholastic Aptitude Test or the Iowa Test of Basic Skills, or a variety of tests that fit this category, where a test is given to a broad population, and that population's score is treated as an average or it's set as a norm for that test. And then when the test is given to other populations, those scores are compared to the average or the norm. That's called a normed reference test. A criterion reference test is slightly different in the type that is used in Oregon, which is the type of assessment that measures specific goals and specific objectives that are contained in the standard. The criteria, in other words, are does the student demonstrate knowledge of that particular standard? That's called a criterion reference test. The law further directs the department to assess performance, that is, the application of knowledge, and we do that in two areas, one in the area of writing, actually collecting samples of student writing, and the other is in students' math problem solving, their ability to use math skills to solve problems. We are directed to conduct that assessment at the benchmark years and to produce results each year at the district level and at the school level, and that is the information that is used in the state accountability system, the state report card system that I've discussed with your committee earlier. So that's, if you will, the legal framework. This is, the assessment system is contained in state law to do both criterion referenced or multiple choice types of tests that measure our state standards and measures of students' ability to apply their knowledge. We've also provided, you were here to talk about assessment, but obviously a very important part of this is the establishment of the state's academic content standards. That was directed in state law in 1996 for the department to create those standards. They're contained in newspaper-type documents that I believe the committee has copies of. Those are the academic content standards of the state. So let me now turn it over to Mr. Costi. He'll talk about how we operationalize this task under state law.
Thank you, Pat.
Excuse me, before you proceed, may we interject with questions as we go forward?
Of course.
Thank you. Representative Dahl.
Yes, sir. Pardon me, Mr. Brake. I want to, for the record, who designed the criteria for the tests? You say the department, but I'd like you to amplify that just a tad so we know who did that.
Correct. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dolan. The process that we followed in 1996 was to bring in panels of teachers from around the state at the benchmark years to look at the standards and then to begin a process of writing sample test items. And those sample test items were then taken out to the field and field tested with large populations of students. And each test item is assigned a level of difficulty. There's a technical term, it's called a Rosh unit score, Rosh being the name of the statistician who developed the technique. And what this does, if you will, it lets you think of these test items in a rank order from less difficult to more difficult at equal intervals, like you would use a ruler rather than using a bell curve. What that lets you do is locate within the span of the standards from third grade through high school where a particular item lies in terms of difficulty. And that information is then used to calculate the overall scores, commonly known as a RIT score or Rosh unit score. But the basic process, Representative Dolan, was that teachers at those grade levels came together in statewide panels and began the process. Now, we've continued to update that process on a regular basis. Sample items are field tested, and as well as the items that we currently use, those that don't indicate a level of validity or reliability are removed from the sample, and we add new items that have met validity and reliability standards.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Costin. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Flores, members of the committee. I'm glad you asked that question, Representative Dolan, and I'm going to give, hopefully, a real high overview of assessment. Part of my presentation is going to be Assessment 101, and I believe it will be helpful to kind of know the basics of what goes into building this system as we go forward so that we can use it as a reference point for discussion and questions. So as part of your packet, I've got a page on the process of assessment through the lens, if you will, of items or questions, how we write them, how we calibrate them, how we put them on tests, how we analyze them and score the results after we deliver the tests. I think that'll be very helpful. The second part of my presentation will focus on the purpose of an assessment system. This is a discussion that I am very concerned about, that we're all on the same page, that we understand what the purpose of an assessment system is from a state perspective versus a classroom or local perspective. I think it's time to have that discussion and make sure that we're all we have a clarity of purpose and a clarity of expectation from the various roles. And then the third part of my presentation will get into the issue of math problem solving, which I'm sure you all want to have an update on in terms of where we're at and what we're doing. But before I launch into that discussion, I wanted to back up a bit and talk about the organization, give you a little flavor for my background, why I'm sitting here today, and what expertise my team brings to the table, and how the organization, the reorganization of Susan Castillo, has impacted the direction in which this office is going. So my background is I'm an accountant by trade and have worked in K-12 educational finance for roughly 20 years. And during that time, I got into technology in the process of implementing HR, human resources, HR, financial planning, enterprise resource planning, ERP. Type system. So I moved from that framework to designing custom systems and worked for the Montana Department of Education, went to work for KPMG Consulting. KPMG is now Bearing Point, a Big Five consulting firm, and landed at the department about 3 years ago. One of my jobs was the database initiative. I was a contractor on that job, project manager, and actually moved out here to Oregon and very, very familiar with the Oregon system. So I started in the department as an IT director and oversaw the management of the DBI and other data collection mechanisms within the state. Had another role as the school finance director during the last legislative session, so I kept my fingers on the finance aspect. And then 10 months ago, during Susan's reorg, they looked at my skills in terms of large-scale systems development and implementation and thought I might be a good fit in this position. So to clarify my background, it's more of a systems approach. I am not an educator. I have been involved in education, but if you throw terminology at me that is education related, I may look at you like I don't know or understand what you're talking about. Mine comes from a systems background and project management. So with that, we were fortunate that the superintendent identified the need to appoint or hire an internal auditor for the agency. So when I was assigned the role of assessment director, the first thing I wanted to know was, what about this assessment system? I need to know some insight on it, and I thought, what better way, being an ex-auditor, to get the perspective from an internal audit perspective. So I requested an internal audit of my section or my office to determine what the purpose of assessment is and what our goals and objectives are to better frame my work plans and going forward. As part of that process, the internal auditor has asked me some hard questions, asked the office some hard questions. You're going to see, kind of get a glimpse of the types of questions he's asking in my presentation when we talk about what is the purpose of the assessment system. It's also important to note that the federal government, the U.S. Department of Ed, is putting the department through a peer review process of our assessment system, where we have to provide evidence that we have a sound, valid, and reliable assessment system. So it is a fairly lengthy process. It means we have to gather a bunch of technical studies. We have to develop plans for additional technical studies if we're not adequate in certain areas. And we have to present those as a body of evidence. And the due date for that is this next fall. In addition to that, we have requested information from testing contractors and the external community on what systems are available, and we have that on the street as we speak. We have seen some interest peaked there. Our intent is to go forward with a request for proposal within the next year. We view that as probably a two-year process to develop and deliver that request for proposal.
And if you don't mind if I interject a question, you have some queries out there with contractors to do what? Specifically?
We call it a RFI, a request for information. So it's a no strings attached information gathering phase. So they have an opportunity to provide us information on what types of assessments that they would provide for the state of Oregon, so we can get a flavor for what the marketplace, what is available in the marketplace.
What type of assessments that would replace some current assessments or be enhancements to the assessments that are currently?
Anything from enhancements to components to the whole enchilada.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Dahlem.
You talked about flavor of the market. If you were to buy my term off-the-shelf program and administered statewide, what would the cost be? And where I'm going to come back to is, what's the cost of our program? So if you bought an off-the-shelf program, what would you pay for it?
The cost, obviously I can't answer on what the cost might be. We know we've got some quotes from a couple of publishers that are, Pat, help me out here, are in the $15 to $30 range.
Correct.
I believe, per test.
We have information from a few publishers specifically about the high school and middle school assessments alone. The American College Testing Service, for example, we have been talking to, and they've quoted us a price right around $12.75 a test. And we're going to share with you some information about our current cost. Mr. Costi has some information to share about that. And obviously this is a complex area. It's not just the question of whether or not someone would sell you a test. It's also whether or not they fit within state law and federal law. And most specifically, the test has to align, has to be directly linked to the state standards in order for it to comply with federal law. So there are some potential cost, not just in buying something off the shelf, but it has to fit the criteria of the law. And that, quite frankly, could add to the cost in order to do that kind of work.
Similar to purchasing a new student information system for a school or a finance system for a school, if you're on one now and you need to move to another one, there is a transition cost that must be recognized. So it takes something to move it from this platform to this platform. That's a very consistent analogy with what we have in an assessment system as well. The challenge is, and the real cost will be in developing the technical specifications for not losing the historical perspective of the data, the school results that we've been, the results of the assessments that we've been able to gather over the past 10 years on our students, and then start a new process. We need to make that seamless, and as Pat referred to, it should be calibrated so that it's at the same level of difficulty, so we don't see a big spike or drop in student test results. It's important to keep that continuity, if you will, with the systems. I guess what I'm saying here to wrap up this part of the discussion is that the superintendent, as well as the state board, as you heard this earlier, are very open about this process. My intent is to make sure that you are informed to the best of my ability and my staff's ability, so you have all of the information in front of you. The state board welcomes that interface and your input, and I believe they're very interested, as you heard, in being part of that discussion and framing the discussion. So with that, I'm going to move forward with the presentation, and I'm going to call your attention to the packet with the blue form, and it's a diagram. It's six phases of the assessment process from the perspective of a test item or question. And before I start, I think I'm gonna review some of what Pat has said relative to the statute, that there are two types of assessments. There's the knowledge and skills, which are typically delivered in a multiple choice form, and then there are the performance assessments, which are elaborate problems that the students need to solve, either in a math or written format. So those are the two types of processes. The item development process that you see in front of you relates to the knowledge and skills type items. The types of delivery mechanisms that we have currently are web-based. We have just about half of our kids, or over half of our kids, taking tests through over the internet, the knowledge and skill tests over the internet. The other option is paper delivery. So tests are printed out, put into booklets, and they're aligned with scoring or scanning documents that then are logistically delivered, picked up, and sent back to a scanning operation. So we have three types of contracts currently that do this whole process. The first contract is, well, actually there's four as I think about it. The first contract is writing the items. Those are teachers that are involved in this process, teachers that understand the content, etc. The second type of contract that's involved is scanning and scoring. That's a specialized operation that actually takes bubble sheets, scans them, dumps the information into a database, and then presents scores and information back to the department. The third contract is the web hoster, or the web delivery system. We contract with a private sector company, Vantage LLP, out of Yardley, Pennsylvania, to deliver our items over a web-based environment. And then the fourth is printing and distribution. So once the test booklets are printed, we need to make copies of them and distribute them to the schools, and that's done by the Oregon Correctional Enterprises. So those are our main contractors at this point in time. ODE staff are typically involved in psychometrics, scoring, doing further analysis, and fitting the information into the AYP and report cards and various other reports. So with that, I'm going to jump into this document. I won't spend a lot of time on it because Dr. Burke hit on a couple of the points, but what I want to call your attention to is item writing. Item writing is a professional development opportunity for teachers throughout the state. We try to do it geographically dispersed so that opportunities are made for as many teachers as possible to participate in these sessions. They write items as needed. So these items go into a data bank. So we have basically an inventory of, or asset bank of items that we have developed using our teachers on our standards. So that is the relative connection to the content standards. It's very important to understand that that's a major cost component as well. And if you think about, you know, contracting out a system, the fact that we have items is a very key component in determining what the cost of outsourcing to a new vendor might be.
Mr. Coffey, if I might ask a question. You have teachers who are involved in making or establishing the testing, mm-hmm. the protocols. And is that done at what point in a school year do you have the teachers involved in that?
These are typically done in the spring of the year, spring and summer of the year.
Spring and summer.
Yep. So it's not during their normal schedule. It would be during a break or off on a weekend.
Okay. And do you know how many are ordinarily involved in this type of a collaborative effort?
It depends on the demand for the specific types of items. There are times when we've had hundreds and hundreds of teachers involved in the process, but it really depends on where we're at in terms of needing more items to feed the bank. That is dependent upon how many items we need to release for whatever reason. Typically, security is a reason that we would release items if we have an opinion or a feeling that items have been exposed and might be used by kids or some other group, then we try to isolate those items and remove them from the pool.
So then, if you don't mind, how often do you go through this process with the collaborative teacher?
This is an annual process, absolutely. And the process, if you go to phase two, involves more than just the item writing. Then they come back.
I did a little pre-review.
Okay.
I guess that's why I'm kind
okay.
of...
Okay, you're jumping ahead.
And just a little, another couple of questions, if you don't mind. And then with the group of teachers that are there at either the spring or the summer, and sometimes 400, or you said many hundred... Is that what you...
There have been in the past.
Okay. And do we have a cost that we associate with that then for this type of a convention or whatever
we call
it?
Yeah, I actually do have costs of item development. It looks like in 2003-2005 it was about $1.2 million for the 2 years.
$1.2 million for just this particular phase one?
That would include the content review as well. I don't have it broken out by
phase
item development. No. No.
Okay.
Madam Chair, just by way of clarification, the bank itself contains about 30,000 tested items that have gone through the process. There's also a process of taking each item through a process of determining whether or not there's any cultural, racial, or gender bias in the item, and then the item is also field tested. The total cost, if you can imagine, about 30,000 of those items that are available. In other words, we don't write the test every year. The tests are drawn from this bank of items. Each item is going to run somewhere around $300 to $350 on a unit cost. So the point that Mr. Costi was making is that represents a significant state asset. There's a lot of value that is associated with that test item bank. And the advantage of having Oregon teachers write the item is, go back to my opening remarks, the statute requires that we specifically measure Oregon standards. So we take teachers that are teaching Oregon standards and involve them in writing test items to measure those standards. So it's very tightly related directly to Oregon classrooms.
Perfect. And then before Mr. Representative Dahlem hopped in, you mentioned then the teachers are the one then that also review the numerous components for whether or not they are sensitive to the areas of overview. So the teachers are the ones doing that review.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We take them through panels that review the item, review the language of the item. We also look at the item for readability and level of difficulty and try to have as valid and reliable a system as we can. And as I said, we also analyze student results on the items, so we are able to pinpoint an item that's either working or not. And there are statistical tests that you can apply to an item where you might look at an array of 20 or 30 items, and there may be two or three items in there that just don't seem to be working the way you would predict them. If they don't work, they are removed from the bank, and the process repeats itself, and new items are added into the bank. So we try to maintain a very adequate supply of tested and valid test items.
Thank you. And I'm not trying to prolong it. I just think it's helpful for me, at least, to understand exactly what this is built on.
Right.
And Representative Ellis.
I'd like to, Dr. Burt, back up one more step. And the standards themselves, determining what students should know at this stage of their development. those also were developed by teachers, weren't they?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, that is absolutely correct. When the legislature directed the department to establish academic content standards for Oregon schools, we had prior documents. They were called Common Curriculum Goals. I'm sure you remember them. They go back quite a number of years in the state. But the legislation directed the department to develop academic content standards. Just a quick method of comparison. We might say that we expect all children to run a mile. I've said two things there. I've identified a population. I've said all children. And I've established an element of content, run a mile. If I say I also want all children to run a mile under 10 minutes, I've now established a level of performance that I expect all children in that content area to achieve. So we took that basic concept, what population, what do we want students to know and be able to do, and at what level? And that work was done with panels of teachers throughout the state over a several-year process. Looking primarily at the benchmark years that had been established in statute at grade 3, grade 5, grade 8, and grade 10. And what body of knowledge and skill would we want grade 3 students to be able to demonstrate or to have learned by grade 3? So panels of teachers met to discuss that in English, math, science, social science, fine arts, and second languages. We also did the same thing at grade 5, the same thing at grade 8, and the same thing at grade 10. So that formed the basic framework. Now, since that time, Representative Dahlem, we have periodically reviewed those standards as well as taken them through external reviews. Achieve Incorporated, for example, reviewed our standards. The American College Testing Service, the Scholastic Aptitude Test, or the College Board. There have been a number of organizations that have reviewed our standards for their content and age appropriateness. And most recently, the appropriate alignment of our standards to other indicators was also very carefully looked at, and be specific. The National Assessment of Educational Progress, or NAEP, is a requirement of No Child Left Behind. All states must participate in NAEP. So we went through a comparison of Oregon state standards and the national standards that are contained in NAEP to see if there was good alignment. What we found in both language arts and in mathematics is there were some areas of deficiency, so the standards were revised, again using panels of teachers, and enhanced and strengthened and were reauthorized by the board. So we've tried to, throughout that process, keep this connected to Oregon classrooms and make sure that our standards align properly not only with state law but with federal law.
Madam Chairman, I don't want to lead Dr. Brifford. Would it be fair if I said to my constituents of Oregon, by Oregon, and for Oregon?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think that would be a very accurate statement. These are Oregon standards developed by Oregon teachers. Yes.
Thank you.
Onward. Field testing. Dr. Burke talked a little bit about field testing. How that happens is these items that have come through these various panels and made it through that filter, if you will, are then field tested on students, and they're embedded in operational tests, the tests that kids take for accountability. Those field test items do not count for their accountability test, but we use them to gather information about those items to determine their usefulness in going forward and becoming an operational item. I'm going to basically stop here for a second before I jump into the next process and tell you that in my background of systems development, I look for mature models. This process is a mature model in terms of an industry best practice. If I think about assessments from an industry perspective, assessments is a fairly immature industry in a K-12 environment. coming from an accounting background, we've been doing accounting for thousands of years. We haven't been doing assessments of children in a K-12 environment for very long. So I need you to understand that from a point of reference of, yeah, the system is a mature system in terms of how others are building their systems. So this is a process that I believe could withstand the test of time. Testing contractors use this same process to develop their items, develop the specifications for their tests, and present their tests to other stakeholders. So just as a point of reference as we're going through this.
And before you move forward into, I'm sorry, one question. If we consider each of these phases as common term in use today as a silo, do you have, for instance, the writing phase and the reviewed phase and then field phase and so on through the six phases in those particular silos? Do you have cost breakdowns in each of those areas as well?
I can get to those costs through SWAG's, Chair Flores.
SWAG.
Scientifically, well, there's two, isn't it? Scientifically, scientific guesses. You can get to that level of detail in the budget through SFMS, the State Financial Management System, if you create enough categories. By creating that level of detail in your budget accounting system, you actually create more potential for error than if you have high-level categories, which is the way we do it. So do I have an individual category for each of these phases within my budget and expenditures? No. Can I get to those numbers? Yes.
We'll go with a SWAG.
Okay, good. Okay. So the next phase on the backside, phase four, is the data analysis and the field-tested items. I think Pat went through that in detail as well. Once it gets past the content and sensitivity and validity panels, we really need to now look at the items and how they performed and how the kids responded to them. So we look at them and make sure that the item or the question has been applied to the appropriate grade level. And if not, we do further analysis of that item and try to field test it in another appropriate means. Once we get this bank of calibrated items, the good items, our assets, then we're able to begin development of the tests or the test construction portion. So here again, Oregon teachers are part of a process for building the test specifications. How do we build a test? What are the right balance of questions to pull together and put on a test or present to a test to really measure how a system is doing? And then finally, we do follow-up. We operationalize these tests. We send them out to the kids with new embedded items, of course, from the field tests that we talked about, the process and methodology. And we let the kids complete these tests, and then we do further analysis on the results of the student results. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. What is the timeline between the beginning of phase one and when it is finally administered to students and graded?
Chair Flores, Representative Tomei, the timeline is roughly 2 years. It typically takes a year to field test an item, get the results back, get an item developed, get it field tested, do the analysis, and then have it ready to be in an operational mode.
Follow-up. Can it be reused year after year, or do you have to redevelop new items?
Chair Flores, Representative Tomei, yes. The beauty of the system is they can be reused as long as we feel the security of those individual items has not been compromised.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, just one quick follow-up, Representative Tomei. There are sample items that are out, for example, on our website. There are sample tests that teachers use to help practice students get used to, especially at third grade level. Some students are not used to taking a test such as this. Those items are real items, but they have been released to the public domain, so it's acceptable to use them in that manner. Those items never appear on an actual test. Mm-hmm. The test items in this 30-item bank are kept in a secure setting, and so the security of the system, as Mr. Costi pointed out, is very important, and any sense that that security has been violated, those items are no longer used, and sometimes those items then get released to the public mm-hmm. for practice and other uses. But if we can't maintain the security of the item, we won't use the item.
Thank you.
Thank you. And before we proceed, and just for clarification, the whole piece is used year after year, and yet we gather year after year to review and analyze if it is reusable.
Representative Flores, or Chair Flores, yes, that is correct. We reanalyze those items if they're fit for further operationalization and testing. We continue to use those tests following the same processes.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm going to move ahead now to the next page. It's a white page, and this is a document that I've asked my staff to put together to frame the policy discussion around the purpose of an assessment system. And I get back to my request for clarity of purpose and expectation. So what is it that really we're here to do, and what is the expectation of the state versus the local relative to assessments? So given that, I'm going to go through the headers and row terminology so that we're all on the same page. The column heading number one, state assessment, refers to a large-scale assessment. It's designed at a state level, and it's administered to every kid or child within a grouping that needs to be tested. It's not a sample type of an environment. A local assessment, on the other hand, is administered at the district or local level, and it is supplemented or augmented by a state assessment. So there are two important clarifications there, because the local school districts, the teachers actually can deliver an assessment of students from anything from a similar type test to professional judgment of an individual teacher. So the row headings are called accountability, and in an assessment world, we call them descriptive and formative. And it's what they really mean are, how are kids doing? How are groups of kids doing? Are they doing as expected relative to a norm and criterion? Here's where they are, but here's what that means. The planning side of it is, what do we need to know as educators to better prepare our students for getting to understand the content, goals, and objectives that they're supposed to understand? So you can see you can see something that's blank there, and I did that intentional by design, that the state does not have a planning component. However, the state assessment can be used to assist planning. During the discussion at state board, one of the state board members suggested that maybe we need to put planning on to the state side as well, and I said that's fair, I'll bring it up here and lay it on the table. But if you look at the state assessment, the cells, from a state level, we're looking at how groups of kids are doing. This is the best analogy I can think of is a rancher looking at his livestock, and he gauges them. He might pick one or two out of the herd and weigh them to figure out if they're on task to go to market in the fall. but that's about as much as we do. Weighing the cow or the calf several times isn't going to make it any fatter. It's just a, here's a measurement, here's a barometer reading of how the system is doing at this point in time. At a local level, though, we're going down into the depths of individual students' relative strengths and weaknesses. How are each of these kids doing? In order to understand what that means, you have to ask a lot of questions about the kids and get to a level of granularity that we're not afforded at the state level. It would mean that we would have to ask a whole bunch more questions much more frequently. And then on the planning side, what are the knowledge and skill areas that most need improvement in this class, school, or district? Those type of assessments exist, and we can augment those types of assessments at the state level, but this is what we do as we gauge the systems. So from a reference point, this is a discussion document. Nothing is set in stone. The board has heard this, and they're engaged. They want to be engaged in this dialogue.
Any questions? Okay. Were you going to move forward with the overview of the math problem?
I'd be happy to.
Okay.
I think we've talked about this yellow document that has a 2 in the bottom is a page out of the testing manual that I thought might be helpful for background information for those of you that want to drill into more about what the math problem solving performance assessment is. Essentially, it's an elaborate test question or questions that are presented to a student. They're provided a choice of 3 what we refer to as tasks or questions that they can respond to. And those 3 choices have typically been in the subject areas of geometry, algebra, and statistics. So that has been around for several years, basically since 1997, and has come and gone lately at the 5th, 8th, and SIM level. So that's a little history on this thing. I think what we really want to talk about today is what happened, what was the chronology, and what are we going to do about it. So that's what I'm here to talk about, and hopefully that meets the suits your needs.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So back in 2002-2003, it was pointed out that math problem solving results for 10th graders were higher than normal. And to be honest, we really didn't do much with that information other than to think we maybe did well that year and patted ourselves on the back. In the spring of 2004, the results dropped below what we expected from previous levels. So suddenly we had some concerns.
And could you give us figures for correlating what they were and what they dropped to?
I know they've dropped to 17% at the SIM level in 2003-04. The history is
down from about 43.
43, and I think the previous year was at 50%.
Right. It was about a 29% drop in the number. It was a fairly precipitous drop that we saw specifically at the 10th grade level, but that we didn't see at other grade levels. So it really kind of jumped out at you that there seemed to be a problem at the high school level on this particular year.
So we're talking from 50 to 17% roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so we noticed that, and that was about the time I took over the assessment office. So much of my time was consumed with this new thing called math problem solving that I didn't really know that much about. So in the summer, we decided that the results were such that we would need to remove it from the AYP calculation at the 10th grade level. We kept the participation component, so if the children took the test, we counted that for participation as part of AYP and report card. In the fall, we noticed that the field test items were were behaving oddly, and we needed to make a decision before we notified teachers to get kids started to go into classroom to take these tests that there's a problem here. So we called some folks together. We made a decision to suspend the 04-05 implementation of math problem solving. And you can see the on the reverse side of this document the superintendent's memo to that effect.
We'll insert here, Representative Gollum.
Pardon me for the informality. Mr. Costi, but how long has the math problem solving test template been in place?
I believe, Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, I believe it's been there since 1997.
So we had approximately 6 years of track record to look back on, and then the precipitous drop.
Correct.
Any other questions? Okay, so you found that they were not reliable, so you threw them out, and did you throw them out, or you disregarded them for every grade level at which they're tested?
We actually suspended the test in 04-05.
I'm sorry, your term suspended. Okay.
Yes. That's an important distinction because we did not get to the point of scoring these tests. The kids actually didn't even take these tests, which saved some resources in terms of the classroom, and the tests were not delivered, so we don't have anything to score this fall or this spring. So,
are you concerned with any of the other disciplines that have a similar track record taking a precipitous drop?
Representative Flores, Representative Dahlem, we did not see that happen with the writing assessment, which is basically scored in the same manner, read by two raters that have to agree within a certain statistical time or statistical reference, and if they don't agree, a third rater resolves the conflict. The issue with math problem solving is currently an anomaly. We don't know exactly if the items themselves need more work, need more field testing. If the, in other words, was the item flawed, or is this a question of a drop in the actual knowledge and skill of the student, so that what we were picking up is an actual decline in math knowledge? I would be more worried about that if I saw a similar drop in the multiple choice math scores, which we did not. So math multiple choice seemed to be on the same trajectory, but the problem solving was not. Within that environment, there's also the system problem of timing and when you have to notify people and so on. So the basic decision was, since we are not positive of what went wrong, rather than move ahead with the expense of administering this part of the system, we've suspended it so that we can examine it carefully, answer the questions that I'm pointing out, and get it back on track. So it's going to take some additional research to really get down to the bottom of what happened last year. Since we don't have a precise answer, we've put the assessment this year on hold.
So you're in the process of evaluating what went wrong. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct. And we also, especially under Mr. Costi's leadership, we're also open to the question, is the way we do math problem solving the best way? Is it the most efficient? Obviously, this requires, for example, teachers to score work, which is on the one hand, a very valid way of scoring work, but it also means that teachers have to be trained to, if you and I were to look at the same piece of work, we have to have some agreement among ourselves of what that level of work would look like. That requires training and bringing more people into the process. So we want to look at, are there other areas, other ways to meet the legal requirement that we assess performance of students, but examine other alternatives to the one that we currently have.
Well, in doing that, have there been other years where we've had this same problem?
We had that happen, as I recall, so before I came to the agency, I believe in 98 or 99, but not to this degree. This is the first time that we've seen a drop like this that we really didn't have a good explanation for.
Representative Long?
I'm going back to that of Oregon, by Oregon, for Oregon. And then, Dr. Burke, when you mentioned teacher training, they were the designers, the implementers, and the practitioners that would receive the result. This is the most peculiar to me. I'm very interested to see what you come up with. And I'd be very concerned if this happened in another discipline. Then, but so far, so good, just math.
That's correct.
A failure.
Madam Chair, Representative Dolan, let me say one additional thing about that. We have had lengthy conversations with math teachers around the state on this issue. Obviously, this generated a lot of concern. There was a lot of publicity about this. It was written about in the newspapers. This was a very difficult decision for us. I would say that the math instructional community is very strongly committed to maintaining math performance assessment in their math instruction. Oregon teachers are very committed to ensuring that Oregon students can apply math skills to real problems and can demonstrate those skills. The process that we use to do that, I think they're interested in participating in and would like to work with us in that process. But the idea that we would just assess mathematics with a multiple choice test is something that math teachers by and large reject. They want to maintain some element of performance in our assessment.
I think we've gone a different way. My concern is not that math teachers are involved, but if we had an instrument designed by teachers, assessed by teachers, and I heard the word training, if our group is building the instrument, why do we have to train them in using it?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Dolleman, I'm not sure that I communicated clearly. But you raise a very interesting question. I was talking more about training in the process of writing the item. That takes some work. And in scoring an item, that usually means that there is a set of criteria, sometimes called a scoring guide or a description of what work looks like at different levels. I could present students a math problem that required strings of summation reaching a final answer. Now, some students might just go single place addition all the way through and add it all up, and they could come up with the right answer. But another student might look at the same problem and use multiplication to get to the same answer. So if we look at that work, I'm being overly simple here, but if I look at that work, I can look at one strategy that got the right answer but represents a lower level of math knowledge and skill as another strategy using multiplication, which is a higher level math skill. So I can begin to make judgments about not only did the student get the right answer, but what strategy did they use and was it a good strategy. And the other thing that we do on the math assessment is we ask students to validate, that is, to check work, to come up with a second strategy that solves the same problem, and to come up basically with the same answer. So it's a pretty rich, very strong assessment. Now, there's one area that we did notice something very interesting. Those districts and those schools that had specifically targeted math problem solving in their instructional program, where this was a goal of the school, where the schools really hit this hard, those schools, by and large, did very well on the math problem-solving assessment. So part of what we're trying to sort out here was, what was the level of instruction? Did the level of instruction statewide adequately contain information on math problem-solving? What we've got is some information that where districts did that, the students did fine, even with potentially a test item that might not have been as strong as others in the past.
my concern is if we have a recurring problem, and if we had this problem in 1998 or 99, we had a rise, we had a decline, 6 years in a cycle. So I'm
Madam Chair, that is precisely why we've decided that we want to really look at this very carefully.
Chair Flores, one of the things that we've done is assemble an advisory group to study the problem. We've brought together the instructional community from districts. We've brought together assessment folks, experts in measurement from the districts. And we've contracted with a couple of national experts in assessment systems, two of whom are fairly familiar with our assessment system. And I guess the walk away that I had from those groups was similar to Pat's. The instructional community really valued this type of assessment. The assessment or measurement folks said, you know, there might be a better way to do this. And the national experts were kind of echoing the measurement folks in that regard. They pointed actually to specific areas that we should focus on or concerns that I think I'd like to lay out on the table. One is offering a single task is probably not the best way to measure how a child or how a group of kids are doing. You don't necessarily get the best response if you're only given them one opportunity to respond. And it's a fairly complex, as Pat laid out, response that they have to construct. The second item that they pointed out was offering students choice in their tasks. And I talked about these performance assessments being, here's three choices you have, pick one, and then we're going to ride that pony all the way home. So if a child picks a task or a question that appeals to them based on a graphic or some of the words that are included in it, it may be more difficult than it appears on the surface and might not react the way we would want it to react. So these are nationally recognized folks saying this. And the other one was you could factor difficulty into the process if you initiate a scaling methodology up front. In other words, as part of the field test design for these types of performance assessments, if you do some really good analysis, if you get enough responses back that you can actually gauge, like we do in the multiple choice questions, calibrate those questions, you can actually have a more reliable test. Those are things that, you know, they pointed out as issues that we need to focus on and work on. So one of the questions I asked the committee, the subcommittee, is to come up with what are some options that we can consider here. Let's just hypothesize, you know, what can we do? One option is let's put all of these options in place. Let's ignore the single task, remove choice, and introduce scaling. That means that, you know, that's probably not a high degree of reliability in that avenue. The second is to kind of come up with a hybrid option in terms of a combination of multiple choice. Find out how can we architect a set of questions where we can throw a broader net at the students to get a better understanding of this math problem solving skills and abilities. And then the third is to look at going down a multiple choice only option. And you could do that through a series of multiple choice questions. One of the national experts recommended a vignette approach. This approach would allow, would mean that we would have to architect a question in such a way that it could be answered from different frames of reference. So we could have the kids answer a number of multiple choice questions based on this passage, and we could draw from their responses how well they understood math problem-solving skills and knowledge.
Well, as you proceed, would I be able to get from you an estimate, a swag, if you will, of what the cost has been to develop these math scoring processes?
Okay. I actually have that with me in terms of a performance assessment in general. I know pretty much what they cost. And this is, we need to consider it's the full nose-to-tail system of developing. It's the item writing, the development of the test, the delivery, the scoring, and then the reporting components. And we're calculating that to be about $13, $12.85 per test, per individual test.
And then multiplied out over the number of students we serve?
Right.
The bottom figure is?
Yeah, well, in 2003-2004, we delivered 288,168 tests. The bottom line number on that was 3,704,167.
And now we're in suspension. We have a
now we're
in
suspension.
And we're in the process of recalibrating.
Mm-hmm.
So as we're going for our accountability as well as effectiveness, we're all concerned about this, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
How do other testing agencies and states, have they had this problem, and have they had to wrestle with this in the math discipline?
I'm going to defer your question. I'm going to answer it briefly, and then I'm going to defer to Dr. Burke because he's probably more in tune with this discipline than I am. But part of the review that we did was to look at performance assessments in math. And there are several states doing math performance assessments, but I believe that we're the only state that provides a single prompt or task opportunity for the children. So others are doing a mixture, a hybrid of modified constructed response and or multiple choice to test their standards. Now, what I would qualify that with is I don't know what their content standards are in relationship to the Oregon content standards in terms of our expectations of knowledge and skills of math problem solving.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, Mr. Costes answered it very well. The answer is yes, there are differences across the United States. Some states don't measure this at all and rely specifically on math knowledge and skill in a multiple choice area. What we have found is that the Oregon commitment to measuring not only the fundamental knowledge and skill, but also the student's ability to apply that information to a real-world setting is not found in all states. So part of the policy dilemma, I believe, is whether or not we believe that's still a good thing to do. Speaking personally, and as we've said, the math community thinks it is a very good thing to do. Let me give you just an Oregon contrast. We do not do this in science. Our science assessment is essentially a multiple-choice science assessment. And I can tell you that there's considerable disagreement in the science community about whether or not that's a good thing to do or whether or not it's a valid assessment. Many science teachers, including groups of science teachers, have come to the state board asking that we add some measure of performance to science. The basic position is science is a process, not just a recitation of skill, and you don't really measure science unless students are given an opportunity to conduct experiments, gather data, draw conclusions, and write a summary. And so engaging in the scientific process is something they would like to see. We've experimented with multiple ways of doing that, but it can get pretty expensive very quickly if you were to require that. So an alternative would be to consider science performance at the classroom level. This is sometimes known as work sampling, something that would be done in the classroom to measure this. So that's an area that we are still working on, but it's an example of where there's some controversy in the state currently of whether or not we should expand this to science. What we also know in mathematics, just as Mr. Costi just described, this is an area where there are a variety of approaches to measuring it. Even at the college entry level, both SAT and ACT are looking at better ways of doing this. We used a buzz term here. It's called short item response. What that means is rather than these lengthy narratives that the students write in the math problem solving, you give the students more items rather than a single item, and they write a shorter item, including in some cases items that can be handwritten directly into a test booklet, and that can be scored by a rater. And in some cases there are even test publishers that are looking at machine scoring. Most clear example is the writing assessment is now a part of the Scholastic Aptitude Test, or the SAT, and when students submit those writing samples, they are being scanned with computers and electronically sent out to raters around the United States, and they score these items on computers, and the computers gather that information from various raters and produce the scores. So this is an area where a lot of work in the field of assessment is currently taking place.
Can I follow up, Madam Chairman?
Yes, sir.
You said not all states test math, but some do. I'm going back to the original question. If it's just some that do, are they recognizing the same problems with assessing math and science as we are?
Yes.
And are they on their own trying to develop a system the same way we are, developing their own system, building their own mousetrap, if you will?
It's an excellent, Madam Chair, Representative Dahlman, an excellent question, and I would have to say the answer is yes. This is an area that gets a lot of discussion around the United States. I'm going to talk a little bit about this later when we get into the No Child Left Behind Act, and the basic policy question is, are all states on their own, or is there some commonality across states? And the basic policy decision that was made by the federal government was that all states are on their own. All states develop their own standards, and all states develop their own assessments. So now what has happened in the several years that we've been at this is people are beginning to look at more partnering across states and looking more at contractors and other people that are engaged in the assessment writing process. Our concern is to make sure that we also comply with state law that, as you've pointed out, Oregon Standards for Oregon Kids, developed in Oregon, that is an important part of what we try to do.
Mr. Costi, and I'm sorry, I think that what I would like to do is I have a series of questions, and I think I'll put them in the form of a letter to you and maybe ask you back, and we can cover it at that point. Would that be fair to say, fair to do?
Chair Flores, that would be very helpful if you were to do that.
And Mr. Burke as well.
Sure, of course.
And unless there are any questions in regard to the presentation from this panel on assessments, okay, we do. Representative Comey.
Thank you. On the yellow page 2, you might find a misspelling on the fourth. paragraph.
Well, this is a math paper, not a spelling paper.
It was an interesting spelling.
Then what I would like to do before we proceed to the No Child Left Behind component is I have another panelist to come up and talk to us in regard to further assessment information, and then we'll have you come back. So thank you very much. I'm sorry for the prolonged, but it is...
Anytime. Thank you very much, Chair, members of the committee. It's been very helpful.
And I'll be getting a letter to you both. Thank you. And yes, sir? Rob Kramer, would you like to come forward and give us the benefit of some input? And for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Kramer. I am president of the Oregon Education Coalition, which has been very active in Oregon education policy and politics since 1998 when I founded the organization. I started in 1995 with my involvement in education as the administrator of the large federally funded grant project in the five Northwest states, helping school districts, state departments of education, and teachers with their math and science teaching in the five-state Northwest region. From 1995 to the year 2000, I was involved in that. During that time, I founded the Oregon Education Coalition and have been very active here, mostly around issues of charter schools and some other education policy as well, but was involved in the charter school legislation in 1995, which was successful. And at that time, founded another organization, had a nonprofit that I am also executive director of called the Oregon Charter School Service Center. And in that capacity, I've been involved with more than 50 individual charter school development projects around the state of Oregon. I'm also co-founder of a growing network of charter schools called the Arthur Academy Neighborhood Public Schools. We hope to have one coming to your neighborhood soon. We have three schools open now, one in Woodburn, one in Troutdale, one in Reynolds. Next year, we plan to be opening two additional schools, one in St. Helens and one in Portland School District, and we intend to eventually grow this to a network of at least 11 K-5 schools in the Portland metropolitan area. I'm co-founder along with Chuck Arthur, who is the other co-founder and after whom these schools are named. In 2002, I ran for state superintendent of public instruction, and during my campaign, I, of course, traveled the state far and wide and talked to everybody I could about education system, our schools, teachers, parents, school board members, school administrators. And I found on the campaign trail that there was a tremendous amount of consternation and skepticism about Oregon's system of assessing kids, whether or not it gives us valid, reliable data and does so at a cost and an impact on the classroom that makes sense for Oregon. I'd kind of like to start, though, with what I would think the principles of an effective, functional assessment system are. I think, number one, we should try to only measure the academic skills and knowledge that can be validly and reliably measured and use tests that meet the highest standards for reliability and validity, the test construction standards of the highest standards. So that's number one. Let's only measure what we know we can measure with validity. Number two, we should have an assessment system that is the most efficient and cost-effective system possible. And number three, we should make sure that whatever system we implement has the smallest possible impact on the classroom. That is, we're not taking lots of instructional time away from instruction to use it for assessment and practicing for assessment. I think those three principles probably are things that we can all pretty much agree on. It's my view, and I admit I have a different view than Dr. Burke and Mr. Costi. In my view, Oregon's system of assessments fails on all three of these counts. Now, you probably know that Oregon's system consists right now of tests in math and reading at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. There's also science tests in grade 10. And with No Child Left Behind coming, we're going to have an annual reading and math test at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then 10, with a science test interspersed twice between those years as well. So the requirements for our test is kind of being ratcheted up, as you know, by No Child Left Behind. Now, we give, as you know, these multiple choice tests and knowledge tests in math and reading, and also our writing sample test and our math problem solving test. These are called performance tests. The performance tests are intended to measure a deeper level of understanding of these content areas. That's what they're intended to do. A deeper level than it said can be measured by a multiple choice test. And this sounds really good. I mean, if we can do this, then we should. It sounds good. Let's test for a deeper understanding, a conceptual grasp of the content rather than simple factual information. The problem is it sounds good. It doesn't, in actuality, work very well. And we had a very good illustration, of course, of that with the problem with the math problem solving test in 10th grade this last year and in 1998 with the 5th or 8th grade math test as well. So it sounds good, but it doesn't work. We pretend that we're testing for higher order thinking skills. We pretend we're testing for critical thinking skills or math problem solving skills. And this has been kind of the holy grail for educators for a long, long time. to really get at a deeper level of understanding. But the simple fact is nobody's really been able to devise a system to measure that with any reliability and validity. And as Dr. Burke said, state after state has the same exact problem Oregon has with these performance tests. California, in one of their earliest iterations of their statewide assessment system, had to throw out their performance tests entirely. So did Kentucky. Massachusetts is having the same exact problems with their performance tests that we are, as is Washington State. Nobody's been able to do this validly and reliably. Now, maybe we can do it because we're smarter than everybody else and we can throw more resources at it and figure out how to do it when nobody else has, but the fact is, so far, nobody's been able to do it. I sat in front of this committee last session, and I argued that the math problem-solving test specifically was unreliable and not valid. And, of course, officials from the Department of Education argued the opposite. Well, we now have a pretty good indication that that test itself was indeed not very reliable, not very valid, when 83% of Oregon's 10th graders somehow failed that test. Now, they didn't get dumber. That's not what happened here. Obviously, the test questions got harder. In fact, I got a call from an administrator at a school in Milwaukee right after those tests were given. He said, "Rob, we're in trouble." I said, "What are you talking about?" I took a look at the prompts or the test questions on the math problem-solving test for my 10th graders, and I'm going to tell you right now, they were far, far harder than anything I've seen in prior years. I know these kids are going to do very poorly on this test. You can see it just from looking at the prompts or the tasks. Now, why didn't our education officials see that when our 10th grade teachers can see that just from looking at it? And in fact, he turned out to be precisely correct in that in Milwaukee, they reflected everybody else. 80-some percent of their 10th graders also failed that problem-solving test. I think it's time to admit that after millions of dollars devising these tests and training teachers how to take these tests, or give these tests, and training kids how to take these tests, that maybe it's the methodology that doesn't give us good, valid, reliable data. Maybe there's another way to do this, to reflect the same conceptual understanding that doesn't involve these costly and unreliable types of tests. I want to point you to something I took off the Oregon Department of Education website just this morning, just to kind of illustrate some of the problems with these math tests. You have in front of you one of a seventh grade sample test item that's on the Department of Education website. Now, this is seventh grade, mind you. They're asking the kids to take all of the two-digit whole numbers and asking them, what's the probability that one of them starts with a 3 or has a 3 in the number? So out of the 90 two-digit whole numbers, what's the probability that if you choose one at random, you're going to get a 3 in it? Now, let's think about the content that is actually testing for. At seventh grade, do they know what the universe of double-digit whole numbers are? I would hope every seventh grader knows what the two-digit whole numbers are. Can they figure out how many of them have a 3 in it? That's a counting exercise at seventh grade. And now, the hard part of this question would be, can they decide on a ratio, 18 of these numbers have 3s and there are 90, 18 divided by 90. That's the probability. I would submit that this is reflective of the problem with math problem-solving tests in that they only test a minuscule amount of math content. What are they really testing? They're testing communication skills. You can see the lengths to which this student went to prove that he had done this correctly. First, listing all the numbers and choosing ones with 3s, then actually going to the extent of writing every single number between 10 and 99 out, and circling the ones with 3s, and then communicating his answer verbally. If you do an analysis of correlating results of the math problem-solving test to kids' results on other tests, you find the math problem-solving test is highly correlated to tests of verbal ability and not correlated to tests of math ability. What we're testing with our math problem-solving test is verbal ability, and we're calling it a math test. That's a big problem. So as I said, math problem-solving tests have a very small amount of actual math content that we're testing for. They're hugely expensive to both develop and administer. And you've heard about some of the costs in doing that, and especially compared to a well-designed multiple-choice test. And they're unreliable, mostly because they give too many false negatives and false positives, and because you cannot carefully calibrate the difficulty of the questions, as we had so clearly pointed out to us with the problems in the 10th grade math problem solving test last year. So they're not reliable because of too many false negatives and false positives. False negatives, I mean, kid fails the test because he didn't have the verbal ability to communicate his answer. That's a false negative. He knew the math content, couldn't communicate it. False positives, didn't really understand the math, great communicator, writes it all down well, scores well enough on all the rubric to get it done. That's the problem. These are also subjectively scored. I'd like to point your attention to the scoring guide, which I also took off of the Oregon Education, Oregon Department of Education website. If you look at the column, it says communication, and look at the box for the score of 5 and 4. You can actually choose any two at random, really. You're a teacher, you're asked to score these math problem-solving tests, and you are asked to make a judgment as to whether the communication of this problem, whether the connecting path in the communication was enhanced, that would give you a score of 6, or was it just thoroughly developed, that would give you a score of 5, or was it complete, that would give you a score of 4. Now, I would submit that the distinctions between these scores are vague at best and impossible to discern on a consistent basis over multiple people over lots of time at worst. And what the result will be is math problem-solving tests being scored with different scores. Now, the Department of Education, I know, tries to take care of that. If they have a different score by two raters, they take it to a third rater. The question I would have, a score of 4 or better, average for 4 or better, will meet standard with this test. We have a disagreement at the cut score, at the 4 to 5, or 3 to 4. It probably happens a lot. What percentage of the time does that happen? It's very, very costly and expensive to train people to reliably judge these things, and especially because you have to retrain them constantly, because if you train a teacher on how to do this one day, and they go away for 6 months, and then they're given the questions to go score, they're going to forget all of these fine distinctions between the boxes. So it's very, very difficult and expensive. All that aside, and those are all going to the reliability and the cost of these tests, the true problem with this type of assessment is its impact on the classroom. That's the true cost. We can always make more money, but what we can never, ever do is replace a third grader or a fifth grader or an eighth grader's day of instruction in the classroom. We cannot ever replace that. They only get one shot at it. And if we are constantly crowding out days of instruction to teach children how to fill out a peculiar format of a test, then we are robbing children of what we should be giving them, and that's math knowledge and skills, simply to teach them how to go through a process. And I think that is wrong. Now, you say, what is that impact? Well, it's very hard to gauge that. On my campaign trail, I talked to hundreds of teachers, hundreds of them, who said, well, I am forced. If I want my children to do well on this test, what I have to do is teach them how to take a math problem-solving test and practice it every single week. Every week during the year, at the testing years, they'll take a day out of math instruction and teach them how to go through this process, setting up the diagrams, communicating their answer. And again, they're teaching only a small little narrow thing of content, actual math knowledge, and teaching them a process. Now, does the Department of Education encourage that type of teaching to the test? Because that's what it is, teaching to the test. Well, yes, it does. Also, off of the Department of Education's website, recommendations from teachers on how to get your kids to pass the test. Third page says, do this once a week, or at least frequently, so it becomes a more familiar procedure. That's exactly what we're teaching our teachers to do. We have to. Otherwise, they're going to have all the accountability consequences that come with NCLB. So we are taking days and days and days of instruction away from our children in order to teach them how to fill out a form, in order to teach them how to go through this process. That, in my view, is the true cost of the math problem-solving test. Money we can make more of, but we can never replace that instructional time. 2 years ago, we had a bill in this body to replace Oregon's system of assessments, including the problem-solving assessments, with a system of assessments that would be designed, administered by an independent outside testing agency. At that time, I started an online petition to get support for the bill. And in about a month and a half, we had over 3,000 names on the petition, several hundred of them from teachers, school board members, and school administrators who said, this assessment system is not working. Now, I admittedly am talking with people different than the people who are talking with the Oregon Department of Education, clearly, because they're hearing that teachers really support this stuff and really want it to continue. I'm hearing the opposite from the people who, the 3,000 or so people who signed my petition. I also want to talk a little bit about our multiple choice test. Now, first, I kind of want to give a from a 30,000-foot view. Does it make sense to allow people to measure the success of their own programs? Do we let people audit themselves? No. Not because we don't trust them, but because it's just not a good public policy practice. For 14 years, the Oregon Department of Education has been implementing Oregon school reform. We will know the success of Oregon school reform in large part due to scores of students on tests. Those tests are designed by the Oregon Department of Education. In essence, we're allowing them to audit themselves. How do we know the difficulty of our tests has maintained that consistent difficulty over the years? Do we have evidence that that is true? Well, we have some evidence that it's not true. I included an article from Brainstorm magazine. This was from a couple years ago, written by a Oregon State University professor. He's an economist, and he's involved with the school in Corvallis, a great school that doesn't find much value in Oregon's assessment system, although they do have to give it. But they also give another assessment system, or another test, put together by the Comprehensive Test of Basic Skills, now called the Terra Nova. So for several years, multiple years, they've given both the Terra Nova and Oregon's statewide assessment. And they found something real interesting. The Terra Nova, they gave the same exact Terra Nova test every year, so it didn't change at all. And the results on the Terra Nova zigzagged a little bit, but they were generally steady. High achievement levels, but generally steady. Their student scores on the Oregon statewide assessment had a market shift from about 1998 onward, a market rise that was not validated by the Terra Nova test scores. Being an economist, he did some analysis, some regression analysis, and some other analysis of that, and found that almost certainly there has been a decrease in the difficulty of Oregon's multiple choice tests as well. Now, at the time, we said there'd be a very easy way to test that, to see if that was true. Let's take 500 kids, and let's give them the 1998 version of the math test, and let's give them the 2003 version of the math test 6 weeks later, or you could do two groups of 500 kids, and let's see. If you have a large population of kids, that would be reflected in the scores. The Department of Education declined to do that analysis. In fact, I don't remember them responding to the pretty significant charges in any way. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that they intentionally made the test easier, but it points out the problem when we let an agency essentially develop the yardstick that's going to measure the success of their own program. I don't think that's good public policy, and I don't think that we should do it. Now, I think I generally agree with the purpose of assessments that Mr. Costi said. We need an assessment system that helps us identify effective teaching, so we can replicate that teaching in other classrooms. We need an assessment system that helps us identify effective schools, which schools are doing very well, so we can take a look at them and see what they're doing and allow us to replicate them. And we need an assessment system that allows us to hold everyone accountable for what is going on in the schools, and I think it's very important that we do that. And finally, an assessment system that gives us good student diagnostics, that we can say in what subcontent areas maybe are some children struggling, that the teacher can use. It gives feedback immediately or very quickly so they can respond to that feedback in the same year. Our assessment system does not do that either. It's getting a little bit better with the TESA, Technology Enhanced Student Assessment, because they are getting quicker feedback with that now, but about half the students take a test over the internet and about the other half are using paper and pencil. But if we don't have an assessment system that fills all those four criteria, maybe we should look at one that does. And Oregon's assessment system does not allow us to do most of this stuff. Yes, for accountability, but certainly no for getting us good teacher-level data on how children are doing. Until we have teacher-level data, we're really not going to be able to answer that question, what's working and what is not working in the classroom. I would submit that there are testing companies, many of them, at least a half a dozen, who have many, many year history of developing and testing, field testing and analyzing test questions with large banks of questions, not just 30,000, but in the, you know, upwards of hundreds and hundreds of thousands. They would happily design a testing system for Oregon that would be targeted to Oregon standards, that would fulfill all of the criteria for No Child Left Behind. That would be cheaper than the way we're doing it now. That would give us data that would not only comply perfectly with all of the principles that I mentioned for a functional assessment system, but would also meet every purpose of what an assessment system should give us. Thank you very much, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Madam Chair.
President Farr.
Mr. Krimmer, what methodology do you propose, and do you have a success rate to demonstrate of these tests that you mentioned?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, are you asking what methodology would I propose to identify a testing company to design a system for Oregon?
What system methodology do you propose?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I would put it out for an RFP to any assessment company that would want to propose to us what they would design for Oregon, give them parameters. Now, we'd have lots of choices in that. We could have a straight multiple choice test in reading and math, which would minimally comply with No Child Left Behind. That would be the cheapest way to go about it. They can also use what would be called a constructed response, where there's some blanks that kids fill in with words, but they're also objectively scored. And then you could also have some short answer questions in there at all, which are a little bit more subjectively scored. Now, you could propose in the RFP to have any one of a mix, or any one of those, or a mix of those, and see what comes back. Now, I in fact did this last session and asked two different testing companies. McGraw-Hill was one of them, and I forget which one the other one, to give us a bid as to what they would charge to do this for Oregon.
And so, can I follow up?
Follow up.
What was the cost, and do you have a current cost? Since that was 2 years ago, I would assume that with inflation, the cost would have increased.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, as my recollection is from McGraw-Hill, the cost was $13 to $18 million for the development and first-year administration of the testing system. Now, I do not have a current cost. I have not gone back to them and asked them to update or revise their estimate, although we could easily do so. And I would be happy to get to you a copy of their proposal.
Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative
Shields. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Krimmer, I'm fairly new to this. Can you suggest a peer-reviewed journal or article that might discuss testing validity so that I could look into this issue further?
Representative Forrest, Representative Shields, the best thing I've read on this specific issue is a book written by E.D. Hirsch, called The Schools We Need and Why We Don't Have Them. You wouldn't have to read the whole book, but there's a section on assessment in that book that discusses all the research, and you know, peer-reviewed and not, but most of it peer-reviewed, and gives his opinion on this as well. And I have multiple copies of that book. I'd be happy to drop one by your office, and you can take a look. It'd probably take you a couple hours to read this entire chapter, and it discusses the research in depth. And it goes through all of these points about what is the cost and reliability, validity, and problems with a problem-solving or performance test type of format.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Krimmer.
Thank you.
And we shall move right along, and no, we're not done. Mr. Burke, we're going to talk about No Child Left Behind and adequate yearly progress.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe you have a handout. I was going to use a PowerPoint presentation. We're having some technical difficulty, but that shouldn't cause a problem. Because everything I'm going to be talking about, I believe you have in your handouts. What I'd like to do, what I've been asked to do, is to provide the committee an overview of the Federal No Child Left Behind Act, and specifically talk about the concept embedded in that act known as adequate yearly progress. The act is quite extensive by way of visual aid, if you will. This is the law itself. It's about 1,600, 1,800 pages. And in federal law, you deal with basically three types of policy guidance. You have the law itself, You then also have rules for the operation of the law, which are published in the Federal Register. These go out for public review and input to the rulemaking process before they are adopted and put into the Federal Register. We are currently engaged in that very same process with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, which was just recently reauthorized by Congress, and it is now in the rulemaking process. And the third type of information, and this type of information is really quite valuable, it's called the non-regulatory guidance. And this is just the guidance on district accountability. There are any number of documents related to the guidance. Probably approaching two full levels of my bookcase right now in my office. The reason I point this out is to let you and the public know that if anyone wants to read or go in depth in any of this information, this is all readily available on the U.S. Department of Education's website. You can get to the law, get to the rules, and get to the guidance. So let me then very briefly talk about No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind is the name given to the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was originally passed during the Johnson administration in 1965. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act needs to be reauthorized every 6 years by Congress, and periodically when Congress reauthorizes the act, they rename it. But the heart of the act, if you will, the basic framework, goes back to 1965. Under the Clinton administration, the reauthorization in 1994, the act was referred to as the Improving America Schools Act, or IASA, and you may occasionally run across references to IASA. In the current configuration, the law was reauthorized and signed by President Bush on January 8, 2002, and went into effect upon the signature of the president. So it went into effect January 8, 2002.
Mr. Burke?
Yes, ma'am.
If I might interject, you said in the current configuration it was reauthorized by President Bush. However, when President Clinton did his reauthorization in 1994, did not then the components that are currently, most of the components that are currently in the what we now know as No Child Left Behind Act, imposed at that point states requiring developing their standards and measures for their tests and so on?
Madam Chair, absolutely. It's a very good observation. That is true. Actually, some elements of the act even predate the Clinton version. For example, for many years, I was a principal for over 15 years in almost all of those schools were Title I schools, and we had the responsibility of reporting annual data called national or normed credit equivalents, or NCEs, normal curve equivalents, or NCEs. As far back as the mid-1970s, we were reporting that information on Title I schools. So you are correct. And some elements of the current reauthorization took some of those elements that were optional and made them mandatory, and in other cases added to some of the framework that was there. I'll be happy to talk about some of those changes as we go through. The purpose of the act is quite straightforward. It is to ensure that all children have a fair, equal, and significant opportunity to obtain a high-quality education and reach, at a minimum, proficiency on challenging state academic achievement standards and state academic assessments. That's a quote from the opening of the act. It is not an insignificant quote. There was considerable debate during the reauthorization process, as I mentioned earlier this afternoon, about whether or not to adopt the National Assessment of Educational Progress and the goal structure of NAEP as the standard throughout the United States, and to have NAEP assessments, or the national assessment tests, be the standard test throughout the United States. As you can imagine, this was a very hotly debated issue. if the Congress had moved in that direction, in effect, what you would have had is a federalized system of national goals and national assessments. And that was the debate, state control versus federal control. And after considerable debate, the compromise that was reached by Congress was that the national assessment of educational progress would be mandated in every state, but in its current configuration, which makes it a random sample rather than required of every student in every school, and that the assessments under the law would be based upon state standards rather than common national standards. That was a very fundamental policy directive established by Congress. Just by contrast, we can look to our southern borders at the government of Mexico, which has a federal system, a common national system, common standards, common assessments throughout the country of Mexico. So this is, it's not, I think, insignificant that this law directs states to establish state standards and to have state assessments of those state standards. The Oregon Board of Education adopted performance goals related to the implementation of No Child Left Behind, and you see those on the handout. And these performance objectives mirror the performance objectives that are contained in the federal law. Most specifically, that we target 100% proficiency over a period of time, targeting 2014 as the goal. That is a target that is established in the federal law.
Dr. Burke, if I just might interject, one more point. When you mentioned that now with the No Child Left Behind implementation in 2001, carrying forward some of the then already required assessments and standards, was it not, and you used the word then became mandated, wasn't that because so many states had failed to meet compliance in the former voluntary?
Madam Chair, it's, again, an excellent question. Oregon, I'm pleased to report, was the first state in the United States to have its system of standards and assessment fully approved by the U.S. Department of Education. That took place under IASA, and that carried forward into No Child Left Behind. We have a reputation as a state for having high-quality standards and a high-quality assessment system. We submitted that to full review by the U.S. Department, both in the old administration, and they were out here 2 years ago and looked at it again. We are also scheduled for peer review this coming fall, as Mr. Costi reflected. So when the law was passed, we actually were able to begin implementation earlier, in that we already had a set of academic content standards approved and in place by in the state of Oregon, and we had an assessment system up and running measuring those standards. We also, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, from the beginning of our assessment system, we had used a criterion reference system. We were not using normed reference tests. The federal law now requires that that criterion reference test be used. So some states, I did some consulting in the state of Michigan while all this was going on. Michigan had a set of standards for the state of Michigan, but they were using the Iowa Test of Basic Skills at the time as their state assessment system. That type of disconnect is not allowed under the federal law. They had to develop the Michigan assessment system to actually measure their standards. So you are correct that Oregon was pretty far down this road under the old law, and some of the things that we already had in place became mandatory in other states with the new version of the law.
Thank you.
Now, we hear a lot of terms, and I really appreciate the chair's direction at our meeting on Monday to get rid of the jargon and try to get rid of the acronym. So one of the pieces of acronym in federal law is the use of the term title. You hear this a lot, Title I, Title II, Title III. What does that mean? Well, the law is actually divided into chapters. It's really that simple. And what you see on the next slide are the chapters of the law. Title I simply refers to the first chapter of the law, and that refers to the programs that are for improving academic achievement of disadvantaged youth. all the way back to 1965, the focus of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act has been to provide supplemental resources, extra support to low-income and minority and for students with disabilities and students for whom English is not their primary language. That has, from the beginning, been the focus of the law. That's contained in Title I. I could go through each chapter, but I think you kind of get the point. Title II has to do with teacher development, professional development. Title III has to do with migrant programs. Title IV has to do with after-school programs and safe and drug-free school programs, and so on. I'm going to talk a little bit in detail about a few of those chapters. Let me talk first about Title I. This is the largest part of the Act and the one that gets the most attention. Title I requires that all states must establish a set of high standards and that they have state assessments that are aligned to those state standards. That is now a requirement of federal law. States are required to define...
I'm sorry, Dr.
It's not a problem.
And should we run short of time, would you be willing to come back and complete the
Absolutely
presentation?
Absolutely, I'd be happy to.
Thank you, Representative Dahl.
But when we say the federal government requires a set of standards in a testing system, the federal government requires a set of standards, a testing system, if you want their money.
That is correct.
Yeah. I mean, this is not a statewide requirement. This is for schools that have qualified and want federal money.
Madam Chair, Representative Dahl, it's a very good point. That section of the law that talks about allocations frequently begins with the section for states receiving grants under this section, and likewise at the district and school level, it will begin with for schools or districts receiving grants under this section. It is an implied contract that when states apply for and receive federal funding in these categories, that they are entering into a contract to abide by the regulations and to enforce the rules. There are a few states, none that I know of, that have actually done it, but there are a few states that have said, well, we just won't apply for the money. That's a significant financial loss. In our state alone, it would be $400 million during the biennium of Title I money alone. So that's something that we would approach pretty cautiously. That's a significant resource that's hard to walk away from. But you're correct. Some states are saying the accountability measures are too stringent or they're not flexible enough, and we would forego the money. Oregon has not taken that position. All students under the law are expected to reach proficiency within 12 years. That was 2004. The law was passed in 2002. All states had to set a starting point to begin measuring that progress toward proficiency, and we had to identify systems of rewards and consequences. The state assessment requirements get phased in over time. We've reviewed this a little bit earlier. By this year, all states had to test at least once in grades 3 through 5, at least once in grades 6 through 9, and at least once in high school. As the chair has pointed out, Oregon already complied with this part of the law, and we were able to implement this right away. Beginning in the current school year, beginning in 2005, as you heard earlier from Mr. Kramer, we have to add assessments at grades 4 and grade 6 and grade 7, because the law now requires annual assessment 3rd grade through 8th grade. So that is an addition that is going into place in Oregon schools. Beginning in 2007, in grades 3 through 5, 6 through 9, and high school, we have to assess in science. Oregon had already developed a science assessment device, assessment tool, and that is already in place. And then we also had to identify what were called additional indicators. The federal system uses a measure of graduation rate that is defined by the National Center for Educational Statistics. And in Oregon, the other measure was attendance. Then the state is, all state departments are required to define in their accountability program how they measure this concept called adequate yearly progress. That's probably a term that you have heard quite frequently, usually referred to as AYP, or adequate yearly progress. Basically, what adequate yearly progress means is that you establish a target, a beginning point, and look at 100% proficiency on state standards by 2014 and develop a plan of incremental targets to get to that objective. Now, what is very different in the federal system when compared to the Oregon report card system is that the federal system requires that that progress be looked at not only for the schools in general, the population in average, but also that the population be broken into subgroups. And those subgroups are students who are identified as being economically disadvantaged. That the measure of that is whether or not the student qualifies for free and reduced price lunch, whether or not they come from a major ethnic or racial group, whether or not they are English language learners, and whether or not they are a student identified with a disability. So it's the state, it's the school average and the district average plus looking at each of those subgroups. And are each of those subgroups making progress toward that 100% proficiency? The next item is also new in this area, Madam Chair. This was an addition to the law that was not in the older law, and that is that all of this information must be reported publicly, and it must be reported not only on the schools that receive Title I funds, but is reported on every school in the state. That is a major change, and again, as a Title I principal, we used to report this information all the time. It would be talked about with my supervisor and program managers and so on, but it was not released on every school as it is now, and of course, it's routinely published in the newspaper, and there's a lot of attention paid to these measures of performance. So let's talk a little bit about performance. What does it mean? The key concept here is that states have established thresholds of performance. It's setting a bar, and where do you set the bar? And then the bar needs to be gradually increased over time to 2014. The bar in Oregon was set at a 40% level of meeting or exceeding standard in English and mathematics, and as I mentioned, science gets added by 2007. So when you hear the term schools that did not make adequate yearly progress, what that means is either the school average or one of the subgroups in either English or mathematics did not come up to that 40% threshold. And it does not matter in the federal system whether or not the school was growing or one school was growing faster than another school. It simply matters whether or not they were over the bar. By contrast, just in theory, you could have a school where 41% of the kids met standard for 3 years. You could also have a school that started where 15% of the kids met standard, and that grew to 30% of the kids meeting standard, and then the next year grew to 39% of the school meeting standard. The school that showed the most growth in that case would have failed adequate yearly progress because it did not meet the 40% threshold, while the school that was holding flat at 41% made adequate yearly progress. And that's one of the areas of confusion and I think some frustration that many teachers, principals, and parents feel that that single bar threshold may not fully capture what we want to know about a school, which is the school getting better over time?
Dr. Burke, Representative Goss.
How was that 40% threshold established? What was the magic about picking that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, the law requires us to look at those subgroup populations based on prior state data and look at the lowest performing subgroup and what their average was. So you kind of you look at a baseline of low performance. If you and then that becomes your starting point. and then you ratchet up from there to 100%. So the 40% threshold was where we were primarily with English language learners. Where would we have to go to get them on the threshold to get to to get to 100% proficiency?
Could I explain that back to be certain I understand? We took the lowest performing schools, established an average, and said that's where we would start as a state to grow from.
Basically, yes, there's some technicalities to that, but the law required us to, in a sense, rank order all of the schools in the state, look at the basically the lowest quartile. It's a complex process that we went through, but you have to establish a base. Now, the reason that they did that, and I don't necessarily disagree, the statute is designed to make sure that all populations are making the appropriate progress. If you just looked at the state average, you're going to leave behind a number of groups that were below that average. And the law envisioned trying to make sure that all children, and particularly all subgroups, were put on an appropriate trajectory. So instead of just taking the state average, we looked at that rank order. If you'd like, I can bring over the whole work plan that lays that out for you.
One follow-up. So we really did, it's not where we started, because we did start at a low 40%. If we started at the lowest quartile and said that's where we want people to be, we didn't start at a high threshold. It's where we're expected to go.
Correct.
Thank you.
And Representative Farr?
I can, for example, the benchmark in Oregon at third grade, the standard score at third grade is 201. The average third grade score in the state of Oregon is 214. So on average, our students are doing well above that minimum state standard. But that begs the question of whether or not there are students below that standard. And what the federal law is particularly targeted at is students in poverty and other students who are performing below that standard, and to ensure that they make progress toward that standard. And it's not just making progress, but that the goal is to make sure that all kids, not just on average, but all kids, reach that standard by 2014. It's probably one of the most controversial elements of the Act. And again, Madam Chair, that is one of the differences between the 94 version and the 2002 version. In the 94 version, it was more whether or not schools were making progress. Were they growing? In the new version, it was, are you at that bar? Establish a bar, and are you at that target with all groups? So it was a significant change in how the numbers are calculated.
To require improvement.
To require improvement. Not only in schools in general, but for all of those subpopulations. At the core, that's one of the most significant changes in the law.
Representative Farr had a question for you.
Thank you. Mr. Burke, I'm sorry to interrupt again, but would a school with a disproportionate number of economically disadvantaged English language learners and or students with disabilities impact performance in meeting these standards?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, yes, it would. And the this is also an area of controversy. There are a variety of ways to think about that. High concentrations of poverty or high concentrations of hard to teach children, such as students with learning disabilities or students for whom English is a second language, if I have a high concentration of that population, I'm certainly more challenged than a school of more affluence with less racial or ethnic learning disability or linguistic diversity. The theory, however, is that's the reason you get the money. The money from the federal government is targeted and distributed on the basis of poverty. So, and that's why it is supplemental to the general fund, and it is distributed on the basis of poverty counts in the census tract data. The information is distributed to districts that way. Then districts make decisions on how the money is targeted to schools, and they must provide that targeting in rank order of poverty. So I hope I'm not being too technical here, but if you I've got 10 schools in my district. The first criteria is a 35% or more free and reduced price lunch population. Then if I have five schools from 35% to 95% free and reduced price lunch, I must show that I targeted that most poor school first. So I have to make sure that I'm targeting the resource to the highest need school first. Now, that doesn't mean that every school that might be eligible has to get money. Let me be specific. You could, I want to do this without getting dinged by the chair and having to get into the acronym pot. There are two types of programs under Title I. One program is called a targeted assistance program, and the other is called a school-wide program. The basic difference is that a targeted assistance Title I program, you identify only specific children who are eligible, and services are provided only to those children. In a school-wide program, you have to provide, you can provide services to all children under certain criteria. And one of those criteria is you have to have, at a minimum, 40% free and reduced price lunch eligibility. I had the interesting experience of, in a district that I worked in, making a proposal that we go to a school-wide model in the district, which we did, and in the process removed funding from the school where my wife worked, and I had the pleasure of going home and telling her that I had just cut her job. So, but there are changes or ways that you can target these funds. For example, you do not have to put money in every high school. Some districts around the state say it's very important to invest in early childhood, so they put more of their Title I resources into elementary schools and fewer of those resources into high schools. Other districts try to provide a balance. But the underlying principle is the money goes where it's needed the most.
Is that correlation true, that the putting the bar at the 12%, so one-eighth of the fourth quartile, is poverty an issue of school performance? Is there a correlation? Does the money go to the right kids?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think the answer is yes, and I'll give you an indication. Over the past 2 years, we have, under the new law, we've had the experience of identifying schools that did not make adequate yearly progress, and we make a distinction between those schools that receive Title I dollars and those that do not. We do that now because the law requires that we do this calculation on every school, regardless of whether or not they receive money. So let me give you an example. 2 years ago, 104 Title I schools were identified as not making adequate yearly progress. Of that 104, the following year, only 44 or 45 of them were still in that category. Now, that's an indication that when you target resources to schools that are in need, they can make improvement, and students do make progress. We've also seen in Oregon that Title I schools have a better percentage of schools meeting adequate yearly progress than non-Title I schools. That's the pattern that I think you would probably expect. The Title I schools get the resources that they need to make those improvements and to target students most at risk of not meeting standard. Having said that, however, there is still a heavy impact of poverty in our schools. We are seeing progress, but there's certainly a correlation, not only in Oregon, but around the United States, a high correlation of poverty and low academic achievement. That's precisely why the funds are targeted the way they are. What we're seeing in Oregon is that those funds make a difference.
Dr. Burke,
yes?
I think we've reached the end of our I would love to stay for hours, frankly. But the committee is getting pretty edgy.
Thank you.
I would invite you back, please, to pick up where we've left off.
Madam Chairman, at your disposal, whenever you
very, very helpful, and I appreciate your very methodical presentation. So I look forward to seeing you when Jim arranges to bring you back.
Great. Happy to.
Well, committee. Yeah. Oh, sir.
Actually, Madam Chair, I really appreciate the information that we've been getting in these, and I wondered if at some point we could maybe invite in the Oregon Student Assistance Commission and have them talk about the commission and also about the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program so that we, you know, because I know there's a lot of interest on the governor's part, and so I think maybe we ought to take a look at it, too.
I respect that, and we will be doing that.
Wonderful.
Thank you. No other business to come before this committee. It is adjourned. Have a nice weekend.